Okay, dear friends, welcome back. Glad you're here. And we move into hour number three tonight and get to talk to Richard Allgaier, my friend of 50 or 60 years, it seems like. He's in hanging out there in Honolulu, and you saw that and heard that wonderful video. It's up at the top of headlines, and I urge you to send it around so you'll understand what's being done to the United States, formerly United States of America. It is a plan. The entire Western world is under a plan, multiple plans, and they're not playing games. This is deadly serious business. They're not going to retract. They're not going to reverse themselves. They're going to continue moving forward. And there is no indication whatsoever that, I repeat, this injection is doing anything less than what it was designed to do, and that is destroy life. On that happy note, welcome back.
It's great to be here, Jeff. It's a beautiful day in Hawaii. Nay, always beautiful here.
You sound a little odd. Are you on a different phone or something?
No, I'm using my good microphone. I just checked it with Todd. Might have a little something in my voice, maybe.
It's a little sharp. Do you have an EQ? It's a little sharp. Not anything, just unusual.
Oh, I know what it is. I do know what it is. Here we go. There we go. I had my microphone set to that.
There
should
it
be
is.
Better.
Yeah.
I had it in, I had the pattern set. I was playing a video while I was on Zoom, and I needed it to pick up sound from both. Your ear is so good. You noticed that. Wow, you have really good ears. It was just a small setting on my microphone so that it would pick up sound from the front and rear.
Yeah,
but I
sounds like the real Richard now. So we're good.
All right. So we'll get to immigration in a minute.
Yeah, sure.
I want to tell you about the Eddie Aikau. This is a great story. I think our listeners will like that.
Uh-huh.
We had the Eddie Aikau big wave surf meet yesterday. Did you see anything about that?
No, I didn't see a clip on it, no.
Okay. The Eddie Aikau is a – they hold it at Waimea Bay on the north shore of Oahu, and – they only run it when the surf is like 30 feet high. They have 30-foot waves.
Yeah.
So they have a holding period. It's between December and February when the big waves come because of the big storms. The waves are generated up by the Aleutian Islands. And so when they say that the surf meet is on, and they said it several days ago, they invite just the best big wave surfers to come. They have like 12 hours to get there and check in. So they held it on Sunday and yesterday, and there were big waves. So who's Eddie Aikau? Eddie Aikau was the first lifeguard at Waimea Bay on the island of Oahu. There didn't used to be lifeguards. And he was a Hawaiian guy that grew up in the like 60s, born, let's see, how old was he? He was probably born in the 40s, late 40s, early 50s. And he was, his family lived on Maui, like in a fishing village, like traditional. And then the father moved them over to the island of Oahu, where they made a deal with a Chinese association where they would be able to, the whole family, six kids, could live in a house on a Chinese cemetery, and they maintained the cemetery, and they could live there free. So that's where he grew up, and they would have luaus and big parties at the cemetery, and it was very old-style Hawaiian culture. And Eddie Aikau loved to surf, loved to play music. He would play Hawaiian slack key, and he made it to about like 10th grade. And he just couldn't, he would rather be surfing. He said to his dad, mm-hmm. I can't handle school anymore. And the father said, well, okay, you're not going to go to school. You got to get a job. So Eddie got a job at the Dole Pineapple Cannery, just right outside of downtown Honolulu. And I can remember driving by the Dole Cannery. It's since closed. It's now like upscale shops and theaters, but used to be this industrial pineapple cannery, and they would, I guess, heat the pineapple. They'd bring it in from the fields, and they'd heat it and do something and put it in cans. And when you drove by, it smelled of warm pineapple. It smelled like a pineapple upside down cake. It was the coolest smell. I remember driving by this industrial area of Hawaii with this wonderful pineapple smell wafting through the air.
Sure.
So Eddie became a famous big wave surfer, and they had a Duke Kahana Moku surf meet, and he wasn't invited because it was the Haole, the white people dominated the meets, even though the Hawaiians
really?
Oh, it was a slap in the face. He was the greatest big wave surfer, and they had this surf meet, and they never even invited him. It was all the George Downing and all the guys from California that came in.
Yeah.
So there's a little bad blood there. So anyway, he's a lifeguard at Waimea, and he saved 500 people. He was Waimea Bay to Sunset Beach Pipeline, that whole Haleiwa, the whole North Shore.
Uh-huh.
He was the main lifeguard, and then when the big waves come in, people were drowning like three or four at a time. But of the 500 rescues, he rescued 500 people and never lost one, which is some amazing record. So
he would go, he would swim out there under those mountainous waves to get to somebody who was in trouble.
You just said a very interesting phrase. You said he would go. And that's a very, just remember that, because this is a very important part of the story. This is the chicken skin moment. This is what will bring you to misty-eyed. So he was this wonderful, sweet Hawaiian guy filled with aloha that risked his life to save people that would go out. And he was a great waterman. So in 1978, there was a Hawaiian sailing canoe. Some people wanted, there was a resurgence of the Hawaiian culture and the Hawaiian history. And they felt, some had said that, well, the Hawaiians came to Hawaii by accident. They got off course and just landed on the islands and didn't really know how to navigate the vast Pacific. And some of these people said, no, they had sailing canoes and they were smart people. They could use the stars and they knew where they were going. So they wanted to prove this. So they built a Hawaiian voyaging canoe called the Hokulea. And Hokulea, hoku is star in Hawaiian. Hokulea means star of gladness, Hokulea. Mm-hmm. And the star of gladness is Arcturus. That was the guiding star for Hawaiian navigators. So they set up this, they built this canoe, set up this voyaging society, and they, no one really remembered how to navigate by the stars. And they found this guy in Micronesia named Mau Pilog, and they brought him, and he was an old-time navigator, and he taught them how to navigate the stars. So Hokulea is going to set out to sail from Hawaii to Tahiti with no modern navigational tools, no escort boat, just using the stars as a map. And they, and Eddie's on board. He's the waterman. He's like the lifeguard. And so in March of 1978, they set out from Maui aboard the Hokulea for this historic journey down to Tahiti. 2,500 miles, open ocean, using only stars. I have a friend, this is an aside, this is later, my friend Sonny Ahuna, another wonderful surfer and great guy. Yeah. He sailed on Hokulea. He sailed to Rapa Nui, Christmas Island, the Cook Islands, and he was aboard that thing for like 30 days at a time, and he just loved it. And he said, when you're out there, the stars overhead are so intense because you're thousands of, hundreds of miles from any light source. And he said, it really is a map. You can look up there and you can tell where you are by the stars, like what, where they set, and everything. So they were going to set sail for Tahiti to prove that this could be done. and they get to be about 15 miles off the coast of Lanai, which is an island off of Maui. And there was a leak in one of the hulls, and the weather got really bad. There were gales, and there were big waves and wind. And the Hokulea capsized. And they're out there 15 miles. They could barely see the mountains. You know, they were that far out. And they're overturned. And it can be cold in Hawaii. By cold, I mean, you know, down into the 60s or 70s. You'll get a chill. And they're drenched in water, and they're just huddled on the thing. And they're stuck there. And they didn't have an escort boat. And they were going to perish. I guess they were shooting flares, but nobody's seen the flares. They had an emergency radio, but there was no response. So they're out there, and they're stuck for a day. And there's a surfboard. So Eddie Aikau says, "I'll go." He says, I can see the island. It's only 10, 15 miles. I can make that 3 or 4 hours. Can you imagine Jeff paddling a surfboard with 10 to 15 miles over the huge waves and blowing wind? And the captain of the boat, Nainoa Thompson, Eddie started paddling out, and Nainoa swam out and talked to him and said, "Are you sure you're doing the right thing? But I got to go." And so he paddled off into the blustery wind, and, you know, he disappears. And so they're huddled on the boat, and they're freezing, and they don't have water, and they don't have food, and it's like they're doomed. And the people on board the boat were just, they were like a prayer, like thinking, "Go, Eddie, go, go, Eddie, go, go, Eddie." And so 30 hours later, a Coast Guard plane flew overhead, and they shot a flare. And then at midnight, in the dark of night, a helicopter came, and they lifted the people off. So they got them on board the helicopter, and they took them to Kalailoa, Barber's Point, the Coast Guard station on Oahu. And everybody had, you know, all the family, and there were a crowd of people and news cameras. And so everybody comes off the helicopter, and they're in these slickers, you know, the yellow rain jackets, waterproof jackets. And Eddie's family's there, and they've rescued them all, and they come off, and it's black, black night. And they say, "Where's Eddie?" And Eddie, you know, "Well, Eddie went for help. Where's Eddie? Where's Eddie?" So he was disappeared. And that began one of the largest, certainly the largest search in the history of Hawaii, one of the largest seawater searches. People on every island, everybody with a boat, everybody with a plane, people paddled surfboards and canoes out. The whole state was out looking for Eddie, because he might have come ashore like on a barren bit of rock on Koho'olawe or Lanai or the Big Island. You know, there's whole rugged uninhabited coasts and Maui. And so people from every island, they searched and searched and searched for days. And it was national news, and it was this huge search. And one day, a few days into it, the father, Eddie's father, called a news conference, and they all went there. And what's he going to say? And he said, "Everybody, just stop, go home. It's time to let Eddie go." And Eddie was lost and never found again. And so he became a cultural icon and a hero. And when you said, "Oh, he would go," there are bumper stickers in Hawaii with his picture that says, "Eddie would go." That's a famous phrase here, "Eddie would go." And so that's the surf contest that's in his honor. And he is still legendary as he paddled out to save those people. And he gave his life. You know, they got saved, but he went. So that's the story of Eddie Aikau. There's a great video on.
Go ahead.
If you want to see a great movie, you can do a search term for The Hawaiian, the Eddie Aikau story. It was done by ABC Sports, and they showed his whole history and him surfing. So, Jeff, you have surfed a wave that's higher than your head, and you know that's a rush. I mean, that's a scary thing. When you're on a wave and you look back and it's higher than you are, just by even 1 foot.
Yeah, yeah.
That gets your attention. Can you imagine taking off on a wave that's like 3 stories or 4 stories higher than, or when you're lifted up, you're making a drop that's like 50 feet straight down. Oh my God. I've never been out and surfed that big.
No, I would stay awfully high and head left or right, whatever. I'd go and stay up as high as I could and then drop down and try and tuck. Wow. No.
Yeah. Well, I think last time we each told the story when we went out on a big day and caught one wave and just went, the whole way in and said, that's it. That was the rush.
That's right. That's very funny. You did the same thing. Yeah, I did. Yeah. I don't know how big it was. It was a couple feet over my head. At least I looked behind me. It's water.
I was out at Waikiki and it came up, and I was out there and I'm going, oh man, you know, I'm like 50 years old. I'm thinking, what am I doing out here? I'm not Hawaiian, and I like to surf like shoulder high waves, like waist high, you know, like a 2 foot wave. That's fun enough. So I'm out there and there's like 10 to 15 feet waves coming through, and I stayed out there for a long time kind of shaking, going, oh man, how am I going to get in? I'm going to have to time this between sets and then paddle my, and I don't want to, I got to paddle in. I'm like more than a quarter mile, maybe a half mile out. Mm-hmm. And I finally just said, well, okay. I kind of prayed to Buddha, you know, please let me survive this. And a wave came, and I paddled on it, and I caught it, and I was up, and I was, oh, man, and I was up so high, just flying across the water like a magic carpet ride. You're just up there just flying, and people don't understand, because when they see video of surfing, it's done with a telephoto lens, so it compresses. Mm-hmm. You don't realize how far you're going on it, riding a big wave. I rode this thing. It just kept going and going. It reformed and broke and broke, kept going and kept going. And I was just screaming, my arms up. I rode it up to the under the beach, you know, Hawaiian beach boy.
Sure.
Songs. Epic ride, huh, brother? I said, that was epic.
That was your wave, said, Dick. That was yours.
No, he said, hey, that was a glory wave, huh? I said, glory ride. Yeah, that was a glory wave. So we've experienced that. So immigration. I hate to
Before you go on, let me thank you for that story about Eddie. That was very moving, and it shows human kind at its best, at its most noble, and that counts a lot. That was good.
Yeah, Hawaiian culture is, I'm blessed to live in Hawaii and be immersed in some of that. It's disappearing, Jeff. They're erasing it.
Yeah,
like
erasing all of our culture. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's the story of Hawaii was overthrown. The businessmen came in that were going to grow the sugar cane and the pineapples. And they brought in armed soldiers and they overtook the Hawaiian kingdom and they put the queen in jail, and the Hawaiian people didn't much like it. I grew up, you know, they didn't teach us. They taught us, oh, Hawaii became a state in 1959 and the people were so happy here. Oh, yeah.
That's all you heard, I'm sure. Yeah.
Yeah, then you move to Hawaii and you hear the real story, like, hey, we had our own kingdom here, and you guys stole it, and we're still not too happy about that. And wow, you learn the real story.
Wasn't there an effort to reverse that some years ago?
Well, Clinton
and go
actually
back to the kingdom status.
Clinton gave an apology in the 90s, but yeah, the problem is Hawaii is like a big aircraft carrier. It's the forward base in the business. Too strategic.
I know.
And this is one big military base. There are so many nuclear weapons on this island.
Oh, you got the biggest X in the world on you. Jeez. Target. Yeah, that's true.
Who was the lady that went over? She was monitoring radiation. I forget her name. I know you interviewed her. I did a story with her. The big island, there's a Pohakaloa training ground, and they're using depleted uranium. She was the depleted uranium lady. I forget.
Yeah, I can't remember.
This would have been about 2006. Mm-hmm. And she took some readings, and I did a story on that. And I touched a nerve. My news director called me in, and there were people, high-powered people on the mainland, just trying to debunk my report. And it was really ugly. I almost got fired. Yeah, I touched a nerve. There was a lot of pushback. Like, that's not to be reported.
Hmm.
Oh yeah, I never told you that.
No.
Yeah, there was they really put an array of so-called experts to, like,
wow.
So, yeah.
Well, now look where we are. Now look at the mess you've gotten me into.
Man, it is. It's just, and it's going to get worse and worse.
Yeah, most unfortunately.
You know, they had they had that 11 million number that was reported. That this would have been in, oh, I remember when you were first doing stuff with Frosty Wooldridge, maybe 2006, 2007, 2008, around that time when you were doing immigration, and that, well, there could be as many as 11 million.
That was the number that was bantied about. Often.
It's kind of like there are certain numbers in history, like the 6 million.
Mm-hmm.
But 11 million, it was like, oh, there's 11 million. They'd come over. Anytime.
Completely made up number. Nobody knew.
2 million more would come. They'd say there are 11 million. Oh, there are 11 million in the shadows. But now the president of Mexico let the cat out of the bag. He said, well, we're so happy there's now 40 million Mexicans in America.
At least. This is within the last, I don't know how many years. It wouldn't be in the last year or two. I just want people to understand that. This has been building for years and years. You know, figure 1 or 2 million a year. I don't know how many on average. And now it's just Katie bar the door. It's a deluge.
When Trump was president, did they have a border patrol agents that would, like, find people and then turn them back? They would send them back?
Yeah, they were still playing that game, yeah.
But they don't do that anymore. They're just like a greeting committee. It's like they become process.
No, you said it in your piece. People, they can use their app and book their invasion time. They can book their illegal entry. They'll get all their paperwork and all their goodies. and they'll be bused or flown to their new home. I mean, this is a it's a takeover takedown.
What they do is they've got the first wave comes over, and they go up to New York or Minnesota or wherever they get taken to.
Yeah,
and then they have a smartphone, and all their relatives down in Nicaragua, down in or over in Somalia or Pakistan, Yemen, Cuba, Haiti, you know, they have smartphones. So the relatives say, well, I'm in New York. Come on up. Just go to the border agent. Tell them, oh, I'm fleeing. I'm a refugee. It's so bad. I fear for my life. And then they'll bus you right up. And now they just use an app. You say, yeah, my brother's in
chain migration.
My cousin's there.
Yeah. Chain migration.
Chain migration worked well for me, Jeff. I liked it because a Korean woman met a military officer, and he married her and brought her to the United States. And then she brought her sister, which is my wife, Mimi. But they did it legally. They learned English. Mimi learned how to speak English. She learned the Constitution, how the government works, took all the tests, became a legal citizen, works hard, speaks English, pays taxes. And it worked out well for me, so it was legal.
Got
but
it.
These people are not assimilating, nor are they intended to assimilate.
No, and they don't want to, above all. They want to keep their own thing going, and their own people, their own colonias, their own towns, whatever. They're going to stay together.
Well, the people that run the world plan things at least 100 years in advance. So when they formed the corporation that became the United States, they wanted to give humans the experiment of apparent self-government. Like, okay, we'll have nation states. And we'll have people, they can vote and they can pretend like they're really running things, but they're not.
Yeah.
But this will, and we'll give them a national anthem, and we'll give them, you know, make some money. Have you seen the shot of the money where you have a U.S. quarter with the eagle on the back, and then you see Roman money with the eagle on the back? It's like the same quarter. And then you have Greek money. It's the same eagle on the back.
No, I haven't seen that. That we need a little photo essay.
Oh,
let
me find that. Let me see if I can.
So they're copying ancient coin now, basically.
Well, it's been the same owner. U.S. quarter. Let me see if I can search how I can find this. Roman coin, Greek coin. Okay, I found it. No, I didn't. But if you, the eagle on the back, there's a graphic that shows it's the same. They look just the same. So what it is, it's the same owners. The same people that were running ancient Greece, the same people that were running Rome, and they run America. And they use the same symbol, the same symbology. Yeah. So it's people have no idea. So anyway, the people that
you just summed it all up, Dick. They just don't have any idea. It's not their fault. They just don't have it. They don't have the, honestly speaking, they don't have the intellectual prowess to wade through this horror and make sense of it. And I don't blame them. It's not easy. It's too big for them. And they're not taught to be proactive in their thinking processes. They're reactive. They just go through life reacting to stimuli, and that's pretty much it. It's a whole different, these two youngest generations are just not, they don't have it. They don't have what we had.
No, they'll have no idea. There's no, there'd be no memory of what we grew up when
They've never experienced it. How could, yeah, there can't be. And so they just don't know what they've lost. They don't know what's been taken away from them. They don't know what they'll never have or experience. They don't know what it might have been again.
They wanted to upgrade America. They wanted to upgrade the world. They wanted to upgrade humanity at the creation of America. So they realized, here's this land with vast riches, you know, minerals and great agricultural potential. And we've got these people that have come over that have this notion of freedom, and they're very industrious, and they're kind, good, intelligent people. So we'll let them spearhead the Industrial Revolution, and we'll give them locomotives and steel mills, and then electricity, and then scientific discoveries. Let those leak out, and these people will—they'll upgrade the whole world, which America did, and become very wealthy. In 1972, those who run the world met in Lima, Peru. There was a conference down there, not unlike what goes on at Davos, but the agreement that came out was, okay, we need to upgrade Asia and bring the developing world up. We need to spread the middle class around, and so we'll bring down America. So what came out of that after that meeting was Kissinger and Nixon went to China, and they made the deals with China. And it was decided in 1972, we're going to move all the industrial production. It'll take 2, 3, 4 decades, but we'll move it all to China, and China will get the middle class, and China will be the next superpower, and America will wither. And they've decided that they're going to bring in 100 million immigrants to the U.S. because the U.S. has had its run. So we need to homogenize the race, and that they don't care. The owners, they don't care. They have no loyalty to nation states because they're above nation states. They make money and they do what they need to do. So you think people are being traitors by, like, well, how could you move all our industrial base to China? It makes good business sense. We make more money. So that's being done, and there's nothing we can do about it.
No.
This
is not defeatism, so don't any of you think that. This is reality. It's pragmatism. These people are not to be thwarted. Americans are not going to rise up and turn this around. They have no access to the mainstream media for openers with which to carry any kind of a message of enlightenment or truth to the masses. They're shut out. So what tools do they have to use? Word of mouth?
Well, who would they...
Social media?
Who would they take on? If they were going to fight back, who would they take on? They don't know who...
They don't know.
Who runs this place.
That's right.
Okay. I sent you the graphic or the pictures of the butterflies that have eyes in their wings.
Yes, I have them.
And then the orchids that look like monkey faces.
Sure, they're up in headlines right now. Let me find the title.
Yeah, hold on. Look at those, and then think.
Oh, I have looked at them. I believe me, I've looked at them. Just a second here. Okay, right in headlines. If you look down, let me see. Let me count the stories. 5, 9, 15, 20, around 20, 27 stories. Dick Allgaier's at the top. Count from Richard down about 27. And you'll see another It says, no accident of nature. Someone is playing with DNA to have fun. Dash Allgaier. It's right there. It's right there. It's right above Scott Adams, the Scott Adams story. And you need to open that up and look at the pictures. And they make the case that the people that created this planet and created essentially everything on the planet have a sense of humor, right? I guess that's one way to look at it. They have a sense of art. They have a sense of humor. Because if you look at these images, I hope you can find them. Just look for it right above Scott Adams. It says, no accident of nature. Someone is playing with DNA to have fun. Allgaier. It's one of Dick's stories. It'll be under his name. It may be under his name right now in the column section. But you got to look at these pictures. They're stunning. There's absolutely no way that these are flukes of nature. These were designed by somebody. It's like they had a paint set. And I called it a DNA paint set. And they just painted with DNA. And this is what nature produced. And their first group are six orchids. Orchids. These are orchids. And they're grinning monkeys. And they are absolutely grinning monkeys. They don't kind of look like, maybe look like, they look precisely like grinning monkeys. Well, two of them aren't grinning. But this is no joke.
Yeah. Well, I did a remote viewing where we do some really deep targets privately. And I got real deep into one, and I saw a being that was like the curator of the DNA. And what I sensed was...
for this planet? Like for this planet?
Well, yeah. Okay.
Uh-huh.
So, okay. And this makes... I can't make this stuff up, Jeff. I mean, I did... This came to me in a remote viewing. Then.
Yeah.
It's like, okay... You have conditions on this planet. If how to explain this? There's a wild bird I've talked about before that comes to my balcony, and
yes.
I put
yes.
a peanut, a little couple pieces of chewed up peanut, and the bird lands in my hand. And I just really like having a wild bird in my hand and look, I feel it, and it lets me pet its, you know, wings. And then I look it in the eye, and it's such an amazing gift of nature, such an amazing creation, this little thing that can fly and come up and interact with me. If you could make such a thing with DNA, if you had enough skill in DNA, wouldn't you do that? If you could do that, if you could.
Absolutely.
Of course we would. Someone has that skill. And so what came to me in the remote viewing, now, some people will hear this and go, Dick Allgaier is barking mad. And some people will listen to this and say, that kind of makes sense. There are beings far more advanced than us, and they can take a planet and they can say, let's set up a game on this planet, and let's go down, like the average temperature is this, it's got this much oxygen, it's got this much nitrogen, carbon dioxide, we need to make it have seasons and tides, otherwise it'll get kind of stagnant. So, okay, let's build an artificial moon, and we'll tow it in and put it at just the right distance, and then we'll make it so it doesn't turn so that we can have the backside. They can't see it, and we can put all our DNA laboratories and bases there, and then we'll... We'll take what life has evolved on the planet, and then we'll just upgrade it with DNA, and make these species, and it'll be a great game. And we can make birds and, like, dinosaurs, they weren't that interesting. Let's get rid of them, and let's get a bipedal hominid. Okay, get the DNA out. Which one would work, you know? Lot number 12A16C1, I think we could... another race says, let us put some of ours here. So they make Asians, and they make Blacks, and they make Caucasians, and a couple of others, and they seed them, and then they sit back and watch, and then they, along the way, they seed a little technology, and they've done it 6 times on this planet already. And
I would think at least
6 that we know of. That we know of. 4 billion years.
Give it a half a billion to settle down. Sure.
They're what they call the time masters, Jeff. Mm-hmm. They're outside of time. They can, I don't want to say immortal, but we would think of them as immortal. They're interdimensional. So They can watch the game play out for several millennia. Anyway, that's the way it. The universe is a real interesting place. There is a God, one God that made it all. I believe in God, but this planet, this solar system, there are lesser gods that run the administration of the thing.
Some of them can be pretty
nasty. That's why they don't
too.
Tell us. That's why they never tell us the truth about ET. It's like, ET found us in 1947, and we saw a flying saucer. No, the ET made us. It's always been here. It's in all the history behind
sure
the scenes.
Is. It's in paintings, it's in wall murals, it's all over the place.
So we're in things are getting really interesting. You following
you're being gentle and kind.
What they're going to do is we're going into a new civilization, and in order to get us into the new civilization, they need to tear down the old one. So we're in the, take the pieces off the game board and put them in the box. We're just getting to that point where it's all going to, you're seeing corporations are, I did a remote viewing a few months ago. I said, there's going to be big layoffs done by email, and Microsoft just laid off like 12,000 people with a memo. So you're going to see companies going under. You're going to see companies eating other corporations. Only the ones that are blockchain friendly are going to.
I'm afraid we're going to see people eating people too before too long.
That could happen
in the cities when they shut these cities off, and there's a war or some other kind of famine where there's no food going in there. It may or may not be electricity. They're going to reduce to the lowest common denominator very quickly. And they will eat human beings, no question.
Been done before, yeah.
When you remote view on the question or the concept of an omnipotent being, a god, shows up. What do you come up with so far? What's your best? Have you done that one?
I haven't ever really done that target. Mm-hmm. I'd have to. We'd bring Edward Reardon on. I bet he's probably done that. I shy away from such tasks.
Maybe that's off limits. Is that off limits?
We were just having a really interesting discussion with our new remote viewing group yesterday. We have a meeting every Sunday where we get on Zoom and we talk for like 3 hours about conceptual things about remote viewing, and we were like, do you have a liminal barrier, or can you self-censor your remote viewing? And Glenn and I were of the mind that know, it's the inability to remote view something is a limit of the skill of the remote viewer, not some hidden safety valve in your subconscious. Somebody said, well, if it's a bloody event where somebody's been murdered, I just won't see that. And I said, I do. And I pulled out the clip from the video that you and I made on Uncle Adi.
Mm-hmm.
Courtney Brown gave me the death of Adolf Hitler in the bunker. And I clearly saw somebody, I saw a guy lying there in the blood, and I drew it, and it was like, this guy's, he's walking along, and all of a sudden he's shot in the back of the head, and like, whoa, shot in the side of the head. And then I realized, hey, this was an actor. This was a stage play.
Or it's his cousin, I think. But
this was a stand-in, It was fake, but it was, the guy really died, and you can see me at the board struggling to, you know, like I have this quizzical look on my face like, no, somebody really died. I see it. I could sense the blood, but it wasn't, it was a fake. And I did like hours on this session. I didn't know who it was. And when Courtney told me it was Hitler, I went, oh, God, because I saw him dying as an old man. And buried anonymously, and then
1962.
Yeah, and that's what got the attention. That got some attention. I was contacted and said, "No, don't talk too much about that. That's off limits." You know, Harry Cooper is he's allowed to give his truth, but only, you know, he's kept within boundaries. So he's really smart. He knows what he can say and what he can. But
yeah.
Did you talk to him about his award he got, the Knight's Cross?
Yeah.
I interviewed him, and he came on in a tuxedo wearing his Knight's Cross.
He's very proud of it. It's nice to see. He's earned it. Yeah, for sure.
Well, when he told me he got it, I thought that one of the old people just had one laying around in a drawer, you know, like my uncle so-and-so had it, and I want you to have it. No, they actually
the organization is still giving them.
A valid order gave him this award. That's a really big deal. So congratulations to Harry.
He has it at pictured at the bottom of his emails that he sends out almost every day. And if any of you want to join one of the most fascinating organizations, go to sharkhunters.com and look around. It's really neat.
How long are they going to keep this game of the U.S. dollar going? How many more are they going to print?
You're asking me? You're the pro. Jeez, I don't know.
Okay, I saw there's a guy that does financial crypto stuff. I forget his name offhand, but he's really, really smart, and he gives very detailed presentations.
Yeah.
And he was showing that the when inflation is running at 6.5% like it was for a while.
Mm-hmm.
They're forced to raise interest rates, but they don't want to raise interest rates. They want to keep printing money. So they need to bring interest down or inflation down, but they can't bring inflation down because they're printing too much money. So what they've done, Jeff, they changed the way that they measure inflation, and they do it like a whole bunch of ways. Hang on one second. Okay, I needed to cough. I'm back. So what they do is they would go from year to year, and they changed it from 2 years to year. So it makes the amount lower. They can lower it to 3% because it's only 3% over what it was before. And then they change the commodities that they measure. Like this month they're not going to use eggs because eggs are going up. So they'll find something that's like, chocolate hasn't gone up, so we'll call chocolate a vital commodity. And they just fudge the numbers.
It's all sleight of hand. It's a game.
A good friend of mine calls it modern art. It's just modern art. They just make it up. But the Federal Reserve. Oh, there I go. I said Federal Reserve.
I didn't hear that.
I don't ever say Federal Reserve.
I didn't hear that.
The private bankers that make money out of thin air and charge us to use it.
The private group of 10 banks, independently owned.
Yeah. When I was a newscaster and I woke up listening to your show, your program rather. And I'm listening to Jeff Rentz, and this was around 2001, early 2000s. Uh-huh. And I listened to G. Edward Griffin, and you had some other people on. You had some old guys, So I'd be on the news, and they'd hand me copy. They said, "The Fed today said they won't raise," and I just always had this thought that I wanted to one day, instead of saying the Federal Reserve, say the private banking cartel that prints money out of nothing and charges us illegally to use it.
Yeah, and loans it
that
to us
the
at
last
interest.
Time.
Yeah. Yeah.
So
it's
that game's going to come to an end, Jeff, and pretty soon.
I know.
It really is. There's a bank in Australia, it is coming out with digital money. It's not a central bank.
It's all in the pipeline. It's all on the way. It's on the way. It'll be here soon.
Bitcoin is 23. Let me look at Bitcoin. It's 23,000.
Nice.